I'm Carlos Frias. This is Sundial. Jack Lepiarz never got over leaving the circus. Until he was six, Jack toured with his dad, who was a clown and circus performer in New York. His dad was sharp as a whip and performed with one too. Jack took after him. Jack eventually went to school like other kids. He got a serious job as a radio journalist for Boston's NPR member station. He covered serious things like the Boston Marathon bombing. But on the side, Jack was still performing, just like his dad. He started doing tricks with a whip at Renaissance fairs. He drew on a squiggly mustache that made him look like a wooden nutcracker, and he put on a terrible French accent and called himself Jacques the Whipper. The audience loved it. Jack realized he missed it. Videos of him performing got him noticed by the TV show America's Got Talent. Millions saw him crack a whip at Simon Cowell, and millions more continue to watch his videos on YouTube and TikTok. And so, Jack ran away to the circus. He quit his job in public radio in February and went on tour. He drives from festival to festival all over the country. He wows and disarms crowds with his whip and his wit. He'll be at the Florida Renaissance Festival in Deerfield Beach until March 26th, and today he's with us in studio.
Bonjour. It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for making the drive down here. You're in Deerfield, so I felt like we had to make the most of our opportunity and get a chance to talk to you about the guy who just ran away to the circus.
Yeah, it's a little bit of a different experience. I've gotten a text from my old boss a few weeks ago saying all of us are very proud. Some of us are a little jealous. And this is the man who hired me at my old station, too.
Let me tell you, we were hanging out in the cafeteria a second ago, and I was like, I can if they look like ours, I can see why you ran away to the circus.
Yeah, fair.
So you were six.
Yeah.
And in a traveling circus. Describe what being a kid in a circus is like when the lights are off.
I always describe it as just imagine a group, a pack of feral toddlers that haven't bathed in a week. Just like crawling underneath the circus tent to like catch all the food that falls down from the bleachers. Like we would find like half full boxes of popcorn. We would get like the half eaten cotton candy that's still like very clearly someone had slobbered all over. It was not the most hygienic of upbringings, but it was a very independent upbringing. It was a lot of fun. I mean, it's you know, we had school. It was not a full school day, and they implemented better kind of education standards after I left. But when I was there, it was kind of every single kid there was in the exact same classroom, and it was ages, 3 to 13.
Wow.
So you can imagine, you know, the structure behind it, a little out there.
How did that situation come to be? How did you end up being a kid traveling with a circus?
So it was my dad had been a circus performer for more than a decade at that point. He had done Renaissance festivals in the 80s, which is where he met my mother. They got married. They had me. My mother was teaching at Baylor University down in Texas. My dad was just joining the Big Apple Circus. So he was on the road. She was teaching. She got a different teaching job in Jersey. And so it was kind of, I was sort of splitting time between the two sides. You know, I might spend the week with her, the weekend with him on the road, or I would go, you know, on the road with him for, you know, a couple of weeks to a month at a time, just living out of the trailer.
What was that arrangement like for your folks? Were they, did they maximize their time with you? How did that go?
They were both so busy that it was, it was kind of all over the place. They split up when I was about 6 years old. Basically, as soon as my dad left the circus and they had to live in one household, they split up. But it was, I had a lot of freedom to kind of pick where I wanted to be. And they were very flexible with custody. My dad still maintained a house in the same town as my mom in New Jersey. So when he was home, I could kind of just go to whichever house I wanted to. But then going on the road with him was a little bit more of a project, just because I was still in normal school. So I had to take my schoolwork with me. So, I remember I was 7 or 8 years old, we did a month-long tour, 2 weeks in Taiwan, 2 weeks in British Columbia.
Wow.
And
these are not small trailer tours. No. These are some significant tours away.
Yeah. Brought all the books we were going to read in that month, you know, for class, brought all of my math worksheets. And I think I did them all on the flight back.
Wow.
Saved them for the very end.
I'd love to kind of contrast what your life was like with your mom versus with your dad. Tell me about when you're with your dad, who are some of the kids that you were in class with and some of the kids that were your friends at the circus?
So there's a guy I met when I was 1 year old, like the first time I went to the circus lot. His name is Max, and we have stayed in touch to this day. So his father actually founded the Big Apple Circus where we were, and he spent all 18 years of his life on that circus lot. So I left when I was 6. I went through that kind of culture shock of going from the circus to the real world. He did it when he was 18, going to Harvard University in Massachusetts. So it's, you know, we kind of had this sort of split trajectory where we were friends all through childhood. And around 15 or 16, things got a little strained. And then once he kind of also joined the real world, it was like, oh no, we're the only two people that get each other. My wife always jokes when he and I hang out, she goes, it's really weird because you're the same person, and it frightens me at times. So
I'm curious about what it was like for you when that life changes and all of a sudden you're in a traditional school with kids whose parents are, attorneys or accountants.
I hated it. I never felt like I fit in. And basically the only time I felt like I could relax and be myself was when we would go back, you know, on the weekends to visit Max back to the circus lot. Because my dad stayed in touch. He knew how good friends Max and I were.
This is your buddy who I
grew up with.
You grew up with.
So that was, you know, that was really the only kind of comfortable spot for me. And the other thing, I mean, it was being the circus kid isn't terrible when you're, you know, 6, 7, 8 years old. But you reach a point around middle school where suddenly it becomes a real social liability. Mm. And you know, you start getting called circus freak and they say, your dad's a clown. And you're like, well, you're technically right.
Yep. So, you can argue with her.
Yeah. And so there was a period there where I wanted nothing to do with the circus, and I just wanted to kind of be a normal kid off on my own and just, you know, leave me alone.
But still part of you just really loving that. Like,
well, so I started doing theater instead. You know, I did like the school dramas,
the
spring musicals, stuff like that. And that was really how I started really getting into performing. And that was kind of, I think, what rekindled that performance desire. Because I think from 11 until about middle school, so, you know, only a couple of years, but I did zero performing.
Was there a point that you thought, this performance is my history, it's my past, it's my story, but it's not who I'm going to be? So I better study something else. I'll go be an attorney or something.
Well, so there were so many times. I mean, when I was 16, I wanted to be a writer. When I was 17, I wanted to be an actor. And so I remember I had a teacher, I think junior year of high school, who was like, you know, you've got a really good radio voice. You should look into that.
He was right.
And I don't think he was right for the time. Maybe now as my voice has aged. But, you know, there was this point where I said, all right, well, let me look into this as I go to school. And I went to Emerson College up in Boston, which has a fantastic college radio station. I worked there all 4 years, and radio kind of clicked with me. And I was like, oh, okay, this is a field that people respect, that people, you know, well, most of the time they respect.
This is a respectable field.
Journalism is a controversial field now, unfortunately.
But this is a job that grown-ups do.
Yes, exactly. Right. But at the same time, I knew that I could, you know, go street performing and make more money than scooping ice cream. Scooping ice cream was like $7 an hour was the minimum wage then.
That doesn't sound... So when you're street performing, what are you doing? Where are you performing?
It was really just you go up... I was lucky enough that I met a few people who were a little more experienced with this, that could kind of show me the ropes first. But it was literally just we went out to Harvard Square, and he started setting up, and we kind of just did our tricks and organized it that way. And then when he graduated later that year, I just started going on my own. And I was like, well, I'll just do kind of some of my dad's old tricks, some tricks that I've been working on, and started to just build a show that way.
What kind of tricks? Tell me about what caught your attention? What were you doing?
So my dad had always had this kind of, he called it whip up the crowd. You just do a bunch of flashy whip cracks, you know.
So whip, like messing, entertaining with the whip.
Oh yeah, always only the whip.
How did you decide that this was your thing versus, you know, jumping through hoops of fire or being a trapeze artist?
Well, hoops of fire, you gotta pack all that up. You gotta build the hoops of fire. It's a lot. Like the whip.
It's very inconvenient to walk around with a hoop of fire.
Yeah. So I came in here with a backpack. I could do most of my show with the props that would fit into that backpack. When I was street performing, that was all my props fit into a small backpack. So very easily transportable. The other thing was also, I mean, it was just kind of what seemed coolest to me. I'd watched a lot of Indiana Jones when I was a kid. And the third thing, which was sort of when I started thinking about this more logically, my dad explained to me, he goes, all right, you can spend 1,000 hours and become a master of cracking whips, or you can spend 1,000 hours becoming a master of juggling. There are going to be 20 times as many people who are just as good as you at juggling than at whip cracking. It's a much harder trick to learn, and it's a much less common trick. So if you do this, you will be more unique. And
oh,
that
so
was,
you really stand out more.
Exactly.
Doing the whip cracking.
Less competition.
Yeah, and I saw that you have your bag here. So is there?
I do
is
have
a bag
some,
of tricks in there.
I got a couple of whips in there. Although the ceilings here are pretty small.
No. Please, we're not going to ask you to do that here because I value all our safety. But I would love to at some point kind of let's do a bit of an unboxing.
Yeah, you, absolutely.
You show okay. Actually, let's do that now. Well, you want to dig through and.
Yeah. So I don't have a whole lot with me.
I will say, it smells like leather in here from the minute you walked in.
Oh, okay. Well, that'll be the first one I bring out because most of these are not leather. But this is a whip I've been working on. It's a 4-foot-long whip. It is made in the style of the kind of Indiana Jones whips, which means that it's got a shorter handle. It has this wrist loop on the end. And it's
total of about what, 5 feet long or so?
Four feet is the braid, and then you have this just strip of leather on the end you call the fall, and this is probably about another 30 inches.
All right, so folks who are unfamiliar, I mean, it's kind of like this braided leather piece that's about 3.5 feet long, and then you have the string that looks like a shoelace.
Yeah, pretty much.
But I'm guessing that hand whip can do lots of damage.
And honestly, not a ton, unless you get someone in the eyes. A whip this
let's
light.
Not find out about that.
Yeah, no, that, I almost did my first day I was learning. A whip this size is not going to do a whole lot of damage unless you're really trying or you really don't know what you're doing. It'll leave a welt, but chances are it's not going to, you know, cut flesh. It's not going to break a finger or something like that. A bigger whip, like I have a 12-foot whip at home.
That's the one you use for performing.
Honestly,
very theatrical.
I very rarely use it just because it's usually bigger than the stage I'm on. So it's like, okay, can I crack this without whipping the front row? Yes or no? I'm not sure. So that's sort of I've been using that as a I'm breaking it in to be more of a target whip.
You mentioned yeah. You know. Kind of, you know, that it'll leave a welt. And these are things that I'm sure you learned because it happened to you. Tell me about what you remember learning to use it and some of the things that you learned early on.
I remember it was, I learned when I was 7, just kind of the basic whip cracks. And I remember it took me basically all day to get one good whip crack. And once I got it once, I could get it consistently. But then I didn't really practice it a whole lot until I was about 15. Maybe 16. And what I remember about that was I was going outside into our backyard basically every afternoon in the middle of January, usually wearing a t-shirt, but not shorts, because I learned very, very quickly that if you wear jeans, whips hurt so much less when they catch your leg on the backswing, because that was where I kept getting myself. But my forearms just had welts all over them. My arms, they're fine now.
You look clear now. You look clear now. Okay.
Yeah, I've got tan lines from the bracers I wear. But now I wear bracers for that reason, because I kept getting my forearms so much.
I got you.
But I distinctly remember it was sort of like you would work on this trick over and over and over again, and there would just kind of be this moment of aha, and then it would be, you know, your brain had made the muscle memory pathways, neural pathways for it to work, your muscles to work that way, and suddenly it would all click.
And this trick would eventually lead you to be on a national TV show. But we're going to get into more of that, but we're going to take a little break. We're talking with Jack Lepiarz. He left the lucrative world of public radio to run away and join the circus. He was a featured act on America's Got Talent, and he is in Florida for an upcoming show. We'll be back in a minute on Sundial. We're back on Sundial. This is Carlos Frias, and our guest today is Jaap Lepiaars, also known as Jack the Whipper. He is a former radio host who left to join the circus, and now he does acts that have gotten him on even as far as America's Got Talent. So, Jack, we were doing a big unboxing here, and you brought out a couple of whips, another couple of whips. Talk us through what we're looking at here.
So, this whip is... it's a blue and gold whip, and it is a, you'll notice the first thing is the handle is significantly longer than the first whip I brought out. So the first whip, 8-inch handle, this is a 19-inch handle. It's a 6-foot bullwhip, and it's based off of the one that I used to set my world record, which was most bullwhip cracks in 1 minute. I did 298 cracks in 2020.
And we, it's almost, you have to, you can go on YouTube and watch you do it. It's actually one of your featured videos. And just watch you break this record. I think it's also on Twitter where you have a following. What's your Twitter handle?
At Lepiaars, Lepiaarz.
And you can just see you kind of doing it and go back and forth. And it just sounds like the 4th of July, like a bunch of
pretty
consistent
much
cracking and popping. And it looks incredibly dangerous.
It's honestly not that dangerous. It's more dangerous for the long-term health of your joints.
look, kids, don't try this at home.
Yeah, don't
unless you've trained with Jack.
Don't try it at home. I mean, it's. I had to learn a brand new trick for it. That's called the volley, where basically you just whip the whip, for lack of a better term, back and forth for a minute. You can switch hands as many times as you want. I switched hands once. But the long handle gives you a little bit more of a fulcrum to get a little extra energy behind the whip, and you can also choke up on the handle because the whip has to be at least 6 feet long. So you choke up on the handle, you can make it closer to, 5.5.
And so you've come to become such an expert on this so that you can have shows on stage. But there was a time, like you said, that you watched your dad do these tricks and you were just doing it for fun while you were in college, but you were, I'm going to get a straight job. I'm going to get a job with I'm going to go into a radio station. You ended up at WBUR in Boston, which is one of the big ones in the country.
Yeah.
And tell me about what it was like, what that world was like. How different was that from a circus crowd? Or are we very similar?
No, it's definitely different. I mean, the real world, as I call it, is, it's not to say it's all the same, because it's obviously not all the same. But the rules are the same, which is they are not the circus rules. Everything is just a little bit more buttoned up. Everything's a little bit more professional. So when I went to BUR, I was kind of on the fence. I wasn't sure if I was going to do radio or circus, just because I wasn't sure if I was going to find a job in radio.
So you were still kind of doing both things. You had a foot in each world. What did your parents say? Because talk about two people with feet in different world. Your mom in academia, your dad continued to be a circus performer.
They both had, I think, much higher aspirations for me than the circus, which I think they've started to come around. Given some of the success I've had over the last year. But my father said, the way he put it, he said, with radio, you can reach and potentially entertain more people in 30 seconds than I have entertained in my entire life.
So your dad was, that's interesting. Your dad was kind of saying, go this route.
Yeah.
Do this job.
Well, my father didn't grow up in the circus. It was a choice for him. And he understands the instability of the life. He understands the limitations of the life. And I think he saw that I had an opportunity to do something. I think he aspired for me to do more than what he did, which at the time, if I was going to do anything, I was aspiring to do, what he was doing, just to an even lesser extent, to be honest.
Hmm. How did your dad get into that? Like, because that's always interesting to me. How do you know that you want to join the circus?
So the long answer, which I'll try to make short, is he did a year of working with a theater company in Colombia, and they were doing some kind of political theater. This was the, I think, early 70s.
Oh, that sounds safe.
Yeah. So they were doing political theater. It was not going well. Mm-hmm. And actually, it started, from what I understand, a mini riot. And what he decided in that moment while they were locked in a barn and people were shooting guns outside was that he wanted to be able to go anywhere in the world and entertain anyone, regardless of age, race, language, socioeconomic status. And he decided the circus was the way to do that.
But maybe not die.
And maybe not die in the process, yes.
So how did your folks meet? How did your mom, who's in academia, how did they get together?
They were both working at the Minnesota Renaissance Festival.
What was she doing?
So she was selling incense, I believe.
Okay.
Yeah. So she was working at a booth. So Renaissance fairs, you know, you have entertainers and you have people who run booths, run shops. And I think that was what it was.
And we should say you're going to be at the Renaissance Fair in Deerfield Beach,
yep,
through March 26. So you're in this radio world, and ultimately there must have been a point. Well, you really start covering some serious stories. Covered the Boston bombing, which is about as serious as you can get. Tell me about what that was like, and where was the circus in your life while you're out, you know, reporting these very serious things? You know?
Yeah. So the marathon happened in 2013. So I was just kind of in the process of moving out of. I was the sort of morning writer for 2 or 3 years then, and I started reporting. I think it was that fall. I remember the day of the marathon. I was going to bed because I had to wake up at 2:30 a.m. So I'm going to bed at 3 in the afternoon, and I get a text from someone, and I figure out, like, oh, something happened at the marathon. Went down there, ended up, you know, reporting from, you know, as close to the scene as I could get all day. But then later, you know, what I realized as I started reporting more, whether it was, you know, covering we had a school bus strike, or I was in federal court for the marathon bombing trial for the whole run.
The length of it, sure.
What I realized, and I think what my bosses there realized, was I'm very good, I'm very nimble on my feet with live radio, unscripted radio. If you know, give me a bunch of information and tell me I need to condense it down to 2 minutes with or without a script, I can generally do it pretty well.
I wonder where you got that skill.
Exactly.
Because so much of circus performing, I imagine that kind of improvisation, being the center of the big top, so to speak, for us lay people, that's part of it, right? Is being able to think on your feet and knowing even how to use your voice and your cadence to get people moving and feeling.
And also, I think there's the side of things where it's like, if live radio goes bad, you know, you have a stumble, you clear your throat, you start again. If a circus trick goes bad, you might catch on fire. So the stakes, honestly, are much lower.
Fair enough. Fair enough. So then you're doing all this. Was doing tricks and being part of different fairs and performances, was it almost like an escape valve for these very serious things that are consuming your day?
I don't know if I would go that far. For me, I mean, in the early days when I first started up there in Boston, it was mostly I needed it to pay the bills because I started only part-time. Basically, if someone called out sick, if someone went on vacation, then they called me, they brought me in. So I could not have supported myself with just what I was making from the radio station. And circus work kind of filled that void. And by the time I got a full-time job, a funny thing happened, which was my main show that I worked moved me to a bigger stage, and suddenly I was making a lot more money.
Okay.
And I said, with what I'm making now, this is worth, you know, working every weekend in September and October. And this becomes extra money that I can work with, that I can invest, I can use to pay off my student loans, pay off my car,
Very practical decisions.
Yeah.
But then there's a part of it that's the impracticality of it, right? Which is just the passion. Describe for me what it's like to be on stage performing for an audience.
It's extraordinary. I mean, when you get a really good show, you get into this rhythm with the crowd where they're with you, you're with them, and it's kind of like you're all moving together and you're sharing this moment together. It's a really extraordinary feeling.
Is that something you saw from a distance when your dad was performing? Were you even aware of that?
No, not at all. No, it's something that you can't really know until you experience. I used to roll my eyes at a lot of his shows when he was having great, fantastic shows. You know, I'd be like, oh, it's a dumb joke. And then I told that joke later when I was trying to build my own show. You know,
let me try that, see how that works.
Yeah, yeah. I used to think, I'm like, God,
What's the joke?
I need someone. So he would ask for a whip volunteer. And he goes, I need someone brave. I need someone strong. I need someone with no reason to live. And that's
okay,
that's the line.
That's pretty good.
It is. I still use it today, and it's a good line.
Right.
Sometimes I try to change it up a little bit. But no, I still use old lines of my father's that are older than I am.
So what's the moment where you decide this is too much of an aphrodisiac? This is too enticing. This crowd, this life is something that I want to pursue.
It was two things. One, I think it was, 2020 happened. 2020 happened, and for the first time in my adult life, I did zero performing all year. Zero live performing. So for the first time since I was 17 years old, and I'm in my 30s now. So I had this experience of like, oh, okay, this is weird. And then coming back to it in 2021, I realized just how much I had missed it.
Do you remember what was that first show back?
Oh, first show. Oh my God. It was, it was the first time I've gotten so nervous. I started shaking on stage in years. I don't know if it was nerves or it was just adrenaline. And I just walked out on the stage and people just started, out of nowhere applauding, which I'd never experienced.
Cause people were also, they were glad to be out again for
exactly.
the first time.
Yeah.
And for a lot of folks, you might have been their first big outing.
Yeah. And it's this kind of thing where Renaissance festivals, because they're all outdoors, a lot of people, you know, fall of 2021, a lot of people still were not comfortable being in packed indoor spaces. You can go outside to a festival, wear your mask all day, and you feel perfectly safe. And that was, for a lot of people, that was their first real outing.
So you go out on stage in 2021 after not performing for a year, and tell me about that moment.
I kind of felt like Bo Burnham at the end of Inside, where, you know, he's been in his room this whole time and he finally goes outside and people start cheering or people, you know, a big spotlight goes on him and he's so unused to it, unaccustomed to it. He almost just wants to go back inside where it's safe, where he's become accustomed to it. I had kind of that feeling first going out there, and I forgot a lot of my own lines because I hadn't performed in 2 years at that point. So that was... that was an adjustment. But then suddenly it was like the crowds were, the energy was unlike anything they had ever had before. And you know, I'd been doing King Richard's Fair up in Boston. I'd been doing that show. That was my 13th season. So crowds know me there. I've been a pretty popular act there for years. But this was a whole different energy, whole different level. And then a couple of people, longtime fans, put my stuff on TikTok and it went viral. And that was how we got to here.
Yes, people in the age of social media discover Jack Le Whipper, Jack the Whipper. He's translated. He's gotten his citizenship. They discover you and they begin posting videos, and that changes your life in another significant way. I think now is a good time to take a little break. We've been speaking with Jack Lepiars. He is a featured whip performer at the Renaissance Festival. He's at the Florida Renaissance Festival in Deerfield Beach until March 26. He's been featured on America's Got Talent. We're going to take a little break and be back with Jack in just a minute. We're back on Sundial. This is Carlos Frias. And our guest today is Jack Lepiars. He's a whip performer who has set a world record, and he's at the Florida Renaissance Festival. And one of the reasons he is touring now is because his whip abilities were discovered, particularly on social media. So you get back to performing in 2021, everyone responds, and people start recording.
Yeah.
You're doing your acts. And what happens?
So I'm at work one day, doing the midday on air shift, and my wife texts me, then fiance, and she goes, my friend just texted me this video asking if this is you, and it's me on stage doing, you know, a silly whip song, and it had gotten, I think, 250,000 views. And I was like, oh, that's interesting. I'm like, well, maybe I should make a TikTok account. So I was like, well, I made a TikTok account. I didn't post anything.
You weren't really social media savvy at that moment, really.
Not at all. I had a personal Facebook account.
That's a very old man thing.
Yeah.
I'm with you. It's a very old man thing.
I had a Twitter account that I mostly just used to keep apprised of the news. And I had like two Facebook accounts, like professional accounts for Jacques the Whipper and Jack the Whipper, because no one knows how to spell my name. That was kind of my limit to social media. So I made this TikTok account. I think I commented on it, and the woman tagged me in it, and like immediately shot up to like 300 followers, which is like, okay, whatever. But then a few other videos of my show got posted, and they got 2 million views each. And I was like, oh, okay.
That's a lot bigger than 300.
Yeah, yeah. So I started kind of just posting. I didn't know what I was doing. I posted a show clip here and there. I would post like videos of me being cute with my cat. And I remember, I think the first video that really took off was a video of me doing a whip song to Ave Maria.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. And it got, I think, 500,000 views in 24 hours or something like that.
Wow.
And that just skyrocketed me up to more than 10,000, which was the monetization threshold once you can start earning on TikTok.
And, then did you realize, oh, my God, wait a minute, I've ignored this thing, and now I'm someone who entertains for a living. I am now able to make money doing this, or this is an income stream that I didn't expect.
Exactly. Yeah, it was that sort of thing where, you know, I knew social media could help you with PR, but I didn't realize how much money, or that any money could be made off of it, unless you're, you know, a 23-year-old who's extraordinarily attractive as an influencer. And so,
well, you know, don't sell yourself short.
I'm also in my mid-30s. I feel like a very old man.
But listen, you're keeping it tight. You got the guns out. You're in Florida. You got the guns out.
Right. Listen, as I say, I don't feel old yet, but I certainly don't feel young anymore. So
that seems right about what happens in your 30s.
Yeah, it sounds about right.
So you're posting on social media, and we should say your TikTok now has almost 3 million followers. So you post these you're posting these videos. These videos get posted, and something bigger happens, which is it catches the attention of, like, TV producers, right?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, the AGT appearance,
America's Got
Talent. Yeah, feels more like it's something nice that was on the resume. It doesn't feel like it did a whole lot for me professionally.
Okay.
It feels more like it was a symptom of what was already happening, which was just more eyes were suddenly on my material. And because I had only really performed part-time for the previous 10 years, it was like, okay, I've got this polished show, and suddenly all these new fans, none of whom have ever actually seen my show in person.
Interesting.
And that was sort of what it was a symptom of. Because I remember checking my follower count after AGT, and I think it went up by 5,000, which, I mean, I posted a video last week that got me 50,000 more.
Right.
You know?
Interesting.
So by all means, I am very happy I did it. I had a great time, and I would absolutely do it again. But it didn't feel like, you know, people suddenly saw me and they were like, hey, can you come work at my show?
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
But now you did have a pretty memorable experience. I mean, they obviously do a great job at editing on this show. But you really had like a buildup. Like there, you go in and you do part of your performance, which is, tell us a little bit about the beginning of it before the interaction.
Yeah, so we did this, we went back and forth kind of like trying to figure out a tight 3 minutes of this show we could do. So the first, I would say, minute and a half, just fancy whip tricks, target cutting, working through all that. And that was what I wanted to do. And then my plan was I was going to do a brand new trick. I had never performed it on stage before, where I was going to have Howie Mandel hold a spaghetti target in between his legs.
And we should say a spaghetti target is kind of like these several strands of spaghetti tied together that you can break, and it's obvious to someone watching. You can see him, the two pieces come flying in the air.
Exactly.
So you're going to get poor Howie to hold these spaghetti between his knees.
Well, I'm thinking two things. One, I think Howie is still in shape enough that I think he can hold the squat position that's needed for it.
Right, because you put it between their knees and then you kind of squat down a little bit.
Exactly.
The person, or not you, the person holding it.
They basically need to lean back so I don't whip them on the face as I bring the whip down.
Oh, yeah, that sounds bad.
Yeah, exactly.
That whip could have done some damage.
Exactly, yeah. Right. Well, that's actually the whip we have here.
Okay.
Same whip. But regardless, we find out before I go on the show, literally, I mean, hours before, that Howie is sick and will not be at the show.
Oh, no, your trick, the one that you had been practicing.
The one that I've been working on. So I can do that trick on myself, where I hold the target, I whip the whip straight back.
This seems a little bit like cutting your own hair. Also, with similar kind of devastating potential results.
Well, I'll say this. What's really good about that trick is if I whip myself, I know how to hide it. I can just not say anything, and no one's going to be any wiser.
I'm picturing the old Looney Tunes where the guy holds his breath and runs out into the woods and yells.
Yeah,
and comes
exactly.
Back.
Yeah, yeah. You know, if I whip a volunteer, unless they are really nice, everyone's gonna know.
Right.
So I was honestly a little relieved at not having to do that trick, but I wasn't sure because I didn't want to make Sophia do it. I didn't want to make Heidi do it because they're wearing like 6
Heidi,
inch heels.
Heidi Klum and Sophia Vergara, two of the three judges next to Simon Cowell.
Yeah, and I definitely didn't want to use Simon because I was like, Simon's grumpy. He's mean. He might just refuse to do it, and then I can't. You know, there's no payoff then at that point.
Right.
So I was like, I'm just going to do it on myself. That'll be fine. And then as I'm saying I'll do it myself, Simon buzzes me and Terry says that I should use Simon for the trick.
Oh, okay. So Simon buzzes you, which meaning on the show means like if you get three strikes, your performance is over and you're done.
Yeah.
So he buzzes you once, and at the same moment, the host, Terry Crews, says...
He goes, "Use Simon!
Use Simon!"
Which I thought was just someone from the crowd. And I was trying to get away from that because I really did not want to use him.
Oh, no. But
and
he played ball.
Well, yeah, the thing was, the crowd started chanting Simon. They would not let me out of it.
Wow. So really, it was like this groupthink, this whole mob
mentality.
It was the mentality.
So I kind of look at Simon, and I give this, I'm like,
you kind of just scrunch your shoulders like, what do you think,
dude? Yeah, and he comes on up, and it was kind of this moment of, as soon as I got him on stage, I was like, oh, okay, he's now on my side, he's on my side of the judgment zone. And so now I'm in control.
You felt like you turned him, and now he was your assistant on stage.
Exactly. And now it's sort of, you know, he's being much nicer because I have, you know, his whipping life in my hand, I guess.
And he's invested in you doing well.
Yeah.
We have a clip of it that we're gonna play.
Yeah.
In the meantime, I'm gonna play it, and let's have you watch it, and then we'll talk about it after.
Sounds good.
Now, Simon,
can we make this quick?
I want my phone. I want to take a picture.
I'm not going to make you hold a squat position for long. Here we go. Do not move.
Audio they used as I hit the target, it worried me so much. Like I knew what had happened, and I'm like, that kind of sounds like I just hit him there. That like low tone, that boom. I was like, oh god, no, wait, hang, I didn't hit him. I was getting nervous, and I was the one there.
And it's amazing. They slow down the video in the slow motion. You see the strands of spaghetti kind of snap in the air. And Simon drops an F bomb or something because they bleep his mouth. And tell me what that moment was like. You had performed this trick in front of these people, and you had not killed Simon Cowell.
It was, I mean, the pure relief, pure adoration. I mean, I was so nervous backstage. Anyone who has seen my show a lot immediately could tell how nervous I was when I went out there. But as soon as I got that target and I didn't hit him, I was like, I am in the clear. I knew in my head, I was like, there's no way Heidi and Sophia are going to vote against me after that, and I knew I only needed to get two of them to move on per se, or to make it through, and that was kind of my strategy the whole time. I was honestly expecting Simon to X me or buzz me, so I was mostly trying to play to Sophia and Heidi for most of that. But I knew when Simon got back, almost the first thing he said, he goes, "I think I'd like to change my vote," and I said, "I got it."
You got him, yeah. And he did. He took his X back. And you moved on with the show, and eventually, you know, only one person wins. But
yeah.
Being on that show, you said didn't necessarily change your life, but there must have been a moment being in front of these celebrities and performing in front of them that made you feel like, hey, I belong on a stage this big or bigger.
I don't know about that. I mean, I think what was a bigger, I think, feeling for me. As I was leaving BUR has this performance space, and I finally talked them into letting me do my show, you know, for the genteel folks of public radio.
Oh, on WBUR, you did a version, a full audio show, full radio show?
No, I did a live performance in their theater space downstairs.
Oh, wow.
And so we did two live shows, and we also did a digital show. One of the live shows was streamed, and I think what was really telling for me was when it sold out in 24 hours, both shows. And, you know, we sold thousands of digital tickets. And I said, okay, there is a demand for Jack the Whipper out there.
did your public radio colleagues were some of them for the first time seeing you perform? And
oh yeah,
what was that like? Then going to work on Monday after that.
Well, the funny thing was my exit interview with the big boss was the Monday afterwards. So that was an interesting experience. But it was, I think, for a lot of them it clicked. They said, "Oh, we finally got to see you in your element, where you are most you." I had a coworker there who was, we were on the morning shift together for a few years. Worked together for many years since then, and he's kind of been like my older brother at work. And it was probably 5 or 6 years before he ever saw my show. He came to the fair and saw it, and he goes, "You, seeing you on stage was seeing the real you, it felt like." So that was, honestly, that was when the gears kind of started to turn.
Tell me about, okay, for a minute, mm-hmm. can you embody the character Jack the Whipper?
But of course, I'm French.
When you put on the Jack the Whipper persona at fairs, do you still draw on the mustache?
We must draw on the mustache, because when you draw on the mustache, this is what helps the audience understand that the show is incredibly stupid. And that is what we want to understand. Because, you know, the whips, they are a little weird. Sometimes they are a little scary. So when I draw on the mustache, people understand that this is a place to have fun. This is a place to enjoy yourself. This is a place where all of us can have a fun time together.
I think you could actually pass for French Canadian. So I think that actually works. Do people, how do people respond to that? Do people like that everything is part of the act?
Yeah, it was, well, so when I first started doing this character, he was always French, just because.
Why did he have to be
well,
French?
Well, I took a bunch of French classes in high school, so I vaguely speak French. But at the Renaissance Fair, everyone is English, they might be Scottish, they might be Irish. There aren't a lot of French characters. So this gave me a chance to be weird and to be different and
that's
be unique.
True. Everybody's walking around with a terrible Cockney accent,
exactly.
Right?
But so what I found was the first weekend that I ever did the show, I didn't draw on the mustache. And it wasn't until the third day I performed, I drew on the mustache, and it seemed like everything clicked, that people got from the word go how weird this show was. And it also, I think, helped me get out of my own, you know, at times anxious inner monologue. And it's like, well, if they don't like this show, they don't like Jacques. It's not like they don't like Jack. And that's kind of the way I try to always, I need more of a reminder of that when I'm being Jack the Whipper than when I'm being Jacques the Whipper.
Oh, interesting. So it is definitely putting on the mask, putting on the character and doing that.
Yeah.
And then people responded to it.
Well, yeah, the first couple of years were rough. I mean, just because I was 20 years old when I started doing Ren Faire solo. So there were definitely some learning pains, some growing pains, figuring out, you know, how to pace yourself doing 4, 5, 6 shows a day. But since then, yeah, it's been an extraordinary response.
And so you make this decision that you're leaving public radio and you're leaving your straight job and you're going to follow this passion wherever it goes. And where it goes is you hop in your car and you're driving to different festivals, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So right now, I mean, I drove down here to Florida first couple of days of March. So I did 3 days of driving down here, stopped in, saw my new nephew on the way in Jersey. But then my wife and I will drive back at the end of the month. I'll be back in Boston for a little bit, do some driving to and from Jersey, drive out to Colorado, live there for a few months, come back, drive to Maryland. It's literally, I mean, across the country. And then a few dates that I'm flying to here and there. But pretty much anything that's east of the Rockies, I'm probably driving to.
So your wife is, she's all on board on this,
so
on this circus life.
I need to give her a massive shout out because...
name drop her and give her her due. Give her her flowers.
She has a... full-time job. She is a photographer, videographer. She handles social media for Boston University and somehow finds time on the side to film my shows, edit video for me, cut together, you know, my consistently best performing TikToks. Anytime you see a musical whip song on my feed, any of my feeds, chances are it was edited and assembled and filmed by her. I would not be anywhere near where I am success-wise without her.
Well, they're very good. Those are the ones that they really, the videos really sing. It doesn't look like it was the iPhone was propped up on a on a table on a corner. No.
Yeah.
Is there any part of that non-circus life that you miss?
Not yet. I mean, it's so fresh. It's only been a month. Mm-hmm. Literally 30 days today. So Not quite yet. The good thing about it is, by virtue of my wife still having her job, I actually still have the same health insurance.
That cannot be overstated.
I think there may come a point, especially this summer, the Colorado trip is a long one, that's about 2.5 months, where I think the travel may start to get to me. But right now, I mean, I'm setting my own schedule. There are 2 days a week where I am really working, where you need to be at this place from X time to X time. But the rest of it is, there's work to do on the off days. There's a lot of work. But it's, you know, if I want to sleep in until 9 o'clock, I can do that. If I want to, you know, do all my work at 11 p.m., I can do that. I don't want to do that. But sometimes, you know, sometimes something comes in at the last minute and you get a little extra work in.
So you were a circus kid.
Yeah.
Do you think that you'll have a circus kid?
That's the plan. I don't know that I want them to have exactly the same childhood that I did. I would still want them to have a bit of a structured, I think a little bit more of a structured early childhood. But I'm a firm believer that, you know, I thought about this at one point where, given what I know about how my life has turned out, would I still want to grow up in the circus, even knowing how difficult my childhood was? And the answer for me is unequivocally a yes. One, financially, it has given me extraordinary freedom that most people my age have not had. Two, it's always something that if I desire to be the center of attention, I can bust out. I often do not, to be very honest. I'm very introverted when I'm not on stage. But it always, you know, I play baseball, amateur baseball up in Boston. My guys have described me as the most interesting man in the world. But it gives me an opportunity to now go see the world and get paid for it. You know, there's a Renaissance Festival up in Alaska that I've considered reaching out to be like, hey, you wanna bring me up? I'll take whatever you'll pay me just so I can have a paid vacation to Alaska.
There are worse things.
Yeah.
Is there an end goal? Is there a place that you would like to get you if you could write the end of the story?
I have no idea, because when I first started thinking about making this move, it was before, you know, the real big blow up happened on social media. And my goal was just to be able to make almost as much in public radio as I was making, or make almost as much in performing as I was making in public radio. And now that goal is, if that was all that happened, I would be horribly disappointed. So, you know, the reality of my life now has far surpassed my expectations. So whatever happens next, I'm excited for. I have some ideas of things I might try to do, but right now I'm just trying to enjoy it.
We've been speaking with Jack Lepiards. He is a performer at the Florida Renaissance Festival, where he wows crowds with his tricks with a whip. It's gotten him featured on America's Got Talent, and you can find him all over TikTok. Where can they find you, Jack?
Honestly, the best place to find me is jackthewhipper.com, which has links to my full show schedule, as well as all of my social medias. If you don't know how to spell Jack the Whipper, you can try Jaxie Whipper, or you can just try jacklepiars.com. They will all go there.
Jack, thank you so much for making the time.
Thanks for having me.
That was Sundial's host, Carlos Frias, speaking with Jack Lepiars. He joined Carlos in studio earlier this month. Jack is performing at the Florida Renaissance Festival in Deerfield Beach. You can catch him there this weekend and find him on social media at JackTheWhipper. And that's Sundial for Tuesday, March 21st. Leslie Ovalle-Adkinson is our lead producer. Elisa Baena is our producer and social media editor. Sergio Bustos is WLRN's VP of News. Peter J. Mertz is WLRN's Vice President of Radio and Sundial's engineer. Our theme music is by the Miami Afro-Cuban funk band Paolo at gopaolo.com. And you can download a podcast of this program or any you might have missed by searching WLRN Sundial on your podcast app. Coming up tomorrow on the program, poetry is on our minds as we get closer to the month of April. Oh Miami has a new contest, and you can write a poem about your South Florida neighborhood, and it could land on a billboard in downtown Miami. Sundial host Carlos Frias will be speaking with the founder of the Poetry Festival about all the ways we encounter poetry in our daily lives. I'm Katie Munoz, WLRN's Director of Live Programming for shows like Sundial. Thank you for listening.